So we have a few minutes for some questions. Yes.
I have a question about mitzvahs done since beginning this time, given the humans have been on the planet. Does that mean we, only for a limited time, does that mean we did them in other realms as other beings and did similar deeds?
The question is, since humans have only been on this planet for a limited period of time, then when we confess similar misdeeds, are we confessing misdeeds we've done in other realms and so forth, or as other types of beings? And the answer is yes. Yes.
Could you say something about thoughts and misdeeds? Like, for example, I feel like it would be a good practice for me in the morning to say, I'm not going to indulge in thinking these harsh thoughts. I have a tendency to sort of let myself indulge in harsh thoughts. I won't say them, but I'll kind of go a little bit rampant in there. And what is the relationship of thoughts, harsh thoughts, let's say?
We have difference between action and the paths of action. So the paths of action are what lead to action. So in the foundation vehicle, the thought such as you're having is not considered a misdeed because it doesn't complete an action. It's a thought that would motivate an action, could motivate an action, but it doesn't actually lead you to finish it. So it's like the path of karma, but it's not actual karma. It's a path of an action, but not the actual action itself. So it wouldn't be a karma that you've accumulated, though of course it's still, you know, harmful habituation of your mind. And in the Mahayana, you have to distinguish between afflictions and misdeeds. And so the thoughts that you have are negative, are probably associated with afflictions. Those afflictions are not in themselves misdeeds, but they are negative. Those are removed primarily. In the Mahayana, by removing the cognitive obscurations, the misunderstanding of the nature of things, those are the afflictive obscurations are naturally also eliminated at that time. So I'm making a complicated answer here. But you could say that in the Mahayana, because everything is primarily mind, that these are to a certain extent an action of some sort. They wouldn't be necessarily an action that would have a karmic ripening. They don't necessarily rise to that level, but they're sort of a mental type of action in the sense that covetousness deeds, covetousness, malice, and wrong views are also among the ten misdeeds. So similarly, it's similar to that. So you can use the same antidotes for them. You do the two activities, one at the beginning, one at the end. You can say to yourself in the morning, I'm not going to indulge in these negative thought processes in the morning, and then the evening, check yourself throughout the day. Then you use your mindfulness, awareness, and carefulness to check yourself continuously. And that's probably the way to deal with them. So you could include them among the misdeeds that are talked about here, but we're also talking about sort of the more major misdeeds as well. Yes?
I understand that there is no word for guilt.
Yes.
And we talk a lot about divorce in this chapter.
Excuse me?
I can't find anything uplifting about this particular chapter. Could you perhaps explain?
What about the offerings?
There is the offering, but the number of misdeeds is so, I've done everything terrible.
That's right, yeah. Well,
so could you perhaps, since you are a translator, perhaps explain the difference between guilt and remorse? The way to do that, because I think in our Western society we often confuse the two,
mm-hmm.
And find ourselves more paralyzed by guilt, causing us.
Well, certainly, remorse, regret, here means recognizing that misdeeds we have done in the past is wrong, are wrong. And so this is not necessarily something that's going to paralyze you. In fact, here for Shantideva, it becomes a spur to action, to the action of confessing. So in the Western neurosis, I mean, this is really a very peculiar Western habit of guilt, of thinking, because I've done bad in the past, I'm therefore a defective, horrible person. So we feel shame, guilt, and so forth about it. So on top of the misdeed of having done the misdeed, we heap on top of it all of this negative view of ourselves. That negative view of ourselves is actually we all would have to be, you know, defective people. And if everyone is defective, then no one's defective, because, you know, something's defective is kind of out of the ordinary, different from other people. So, you know, if everyone has all these defects of having done these misdeeds in this and previous lifetimes, then therefore there's nothing particularly defective about you as an individual that calls you out as a specific, shameful, you know, horrid person. So we have this sense of increased sense of ego clinging and pride. It's a form of pride. It's a form of laziness and a form of pride to think that I'm worse than anyone else. And what's that doing is setting yourself away from other people. So we have to recognize that we ourselves are not different from the other people. Just as we have done these horrible things in the past, so have other people. We're not more defective than them. Now, if you take this too far the wrong way, you might go into, say, this sort of nihilistic thing and say nothing's good and end up being, what a horrible world. But that's not the point either. Other people experience suffering because of the wrongs they've done, and they deserve our compassion. So we ourselves need to free ourselves from it. So we need to have compassion for ourselves. And that compassion for ourselves, the opposite of compassion, the compassion for yourself, really means the wish for liberation. I have to free myself from it. That means I have to have the resolve that I'm going to purify these misdeeds for myself and others. So that's a more healthy way to approach it. But when we think about this, the difference would be, do we have that that prideful and lazy ego clinging that makes us think that we're somehow different than other people? Because we are not. I mean, like in our contemporary society, there is, in America, there's the, what could we say, the grave misdeed of racism that is in all of our pasts. Unless you're a more recent immigrant, a very recent immigrant, all of our situation as white people in America is based upon, has a large degree of involvement with the institution of slavery and then the various different types of persecution that have gone on since then, not to mention the other sorts of discrimination that happened towards people who are now considered white but didn't used to be. You know, like Jews and Irish people. You know, so then later Polish and Italian and so forth. So we all, in a sense, as Americans, we share in that collective, white Americans, we share in that collective thing. And this is something that we all share. It doesn't mean that any particular white person is worse for having that or not, because it's part of all of our culture, all of where we are. And so that for us, as you know, becomes a spur that we have to overcome. Just as societally, we have to overcome these difficulties of racism, of discrimination, and so forth. And we shouldn't take it as discouragement for ourselves. We should also recognize that for ourselves as individuals, in terms of the individual wrongs we have personally done, that we also have to overcome those by confessing them and practicing virtue. Yes.
I think I heard you make a distinction between harsh speech and abusive.
Yeah, what I meant to say there, if I didn't say it clearly, is the word is often translated as harsh speech, which is a very literal translation. The actual usage of the word would now leads me to believe that abusive speech is probably better.
Can you say a little more about, are there instances when harsh speech would
be? There are instances where speaking firmly is extremely important. So there's a difference between speaking firmly and being abusive. So like as a teacher in a class, sometimes you will have to speak firmly and say, you may not do this, you can't do this. You have to set a boundary and you have to be firm and strong about it. And sometimes you even have to raise your voice. But that's not necessarily abusive. Now, at the same time, if you're the teacher and you're calling kids, you know, stupid little twerps, that's abusive. That gets back to Tracy's question. Yes.
In one of the verses, it speaks about not having no fear of existence. And number 9, I think, verse 9.
Of the second chapter?
Yeah.
All my pages are out.
9. Number 9, yeah. Because you have accepted me completely, not fearing existence, I will benefit beings.
Okay.
What does that mean, not fearing existence?
Existence has many different meanings. Here it refers to, it's a synonym for samsara. So we talk about bodhisattvas who, because they are not afraid of of experiencing suffering in samsara, they are willing to take rebirth. Shantideva is saying that the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas have accepted me as their student, so I no longer have any fear of the sufferings of samsara, so I will enter existence and I will benefit beings. So it's often, sometimes we see the distinction between existence and peace. So existence would be, in that context, existence would refer to samsara and peace to nirvana. Yes.
I wonder what you think about the fact that we are making all these offerings and then confessing this deed. I think to me it would make sense maybe to confess first, purify, and then offer. But I'm wondering if these offerings are being used again as a specific way to prepare our minds, or what you would say about the sequence that Shantideva uses here.
The sequence follows the sequence of the 7 branches. So we've got offering, here it's offering prostration, sometimes it's prostration and offering. Then here there's going for refuge, which is not always present. Then confessing, rejoicing, and so forth. So the order is given in the order of the magnitude of merit. So you get a lot of merit from offering, but you get more merit from confessing. You get a lot of merit from confessing, but you get even more merit from rejoicing, and so forth. So that is the reason why they're put in this order. Also, I think that, if you can think about it, when you're really making a heartfelt confession, making a heartfelt offering can be a very, think about the emotional experience of doing it. Then what is the experience of making, a really heartfelt confession? It's even more intense. And then so forth. And when you really rejoice, it's like more and more and more. That's why it's more merit. Yes?
In terms of offerings, you mentioned yesterday about how Westerners have a tendency to want to reciprocate. And so
when something nice has been done for them, they want in Thanksgiving, they want to try to reciprocate. That means that they essentially engage in a kind of inadvertent favoritism, mm-hmm. based on just it, but, you know,
yes,
the occasion practically.
Yeah.
So, is it then more appropriate? I mean, I guess I was sort of thinking in that way. I've been thinking in terms of out of gratefulness for the Dharma, for example, which you might mm-hmm. communicate as the translator. Is it more appropriate then to, you know, you sort of, if your first math is you're thinking about the, you know, the various envelopes, you your first inclination is to put more in the translator's envelope. Is it more appropriate actually to then redistribute it equally?
In terms of teaching situation, you know, the teaching situations in the West and teaching situations in Asia are a little bit different. And one of the reasons why I feel like I don't need that many offerings is because a lot of people treat me exactly as you do. So it's kind of a funny thing. But I'm also well taken care of by Rinpoche, and I'm always, you know, wherever I go, I'm put up. So for myself personally, it's like, you know, income I get is money I can give away, more or less. Some of it I fritter away. But what I mean is, like, if you were to visit the monastery in Vancouver, for example, where we have 8 permanent residents, at the end of a teaching, I think, you know, there is, it's fine to express your gratitude by making a gift to Rinpoche. To Rinpoche, it's appropriate as a thank you for getting the teaching. And there's also some argument that you could make about giving it to the translator. Especially someone else other than me. But another thing, that what really we lack in the West is the idea of giving an offering to the Sangha. And so the way an offering to the Sangha, originally it would have been some sponsor coming and giving an offering of a meal to the Sangha, or they would come and make offerings of robes to the Sangha. Later, it's become making offerings of money. And so this is where, in the Chinese tradition, what they do is they get the red envelopes and they put a little bit in each red envelope and give each monk and nun an offering. And now there are some, there are traditions about how to do this. And if you go to Vancouver, or if you come to Asia and make offerings to the monks and nuns in the monastery, then they would help you do it right, because you give Rinpoche 10 times as much, you give Kempos twice as much, and you give certain lamas twice as much, and everyone else gets the regular amount. That sort of thing. So they help you do it in terms of the practicalities. You go to the office and you ask about it. So I think what I'm trying to say is that what I really want to say is that when you think about coming to Bodhanath for Rinpoche's seminar, Vancouver for Rinpoche's teachings, Varanasi for Rinpoche's teachings, or any other monastery, that you think about making an offering to the Sangha, where you can go, and if there are several of you going together, you can pool your resources and do it together, or you can do it individually. And you take a certain amount of money. So if you know that you're making offerings to the Sangha who lives in Vajravidya, and it's the winter and the shelters there, you've got about 150 monks. So you give each one 100 rupees. That's going to be about $150, give or take. So about $200 budget for making an offering. Not 100 rupees. I'm thinking Nepali rupees. You budget, say, I want to make $200 worth of offerings to the Sangha. Or if you come to Bodha, you can make an offering to the monastery in Bodhanath, to the nunnery in Swayambhunath, or any of the various other options. So instead of just necessarily giving money to, okay, the guest house manager, the translator, the helpful monk who does this, think about also giving offerings to all of the monks. This is something that Westerners, by and large, don't do. And And, you know, a lot of our organizers of teachings are hesitant to encourage people to do it. They haven't really got the idea. We sort of feel like it's an Asian thing to do. So Chinese students always come to the monasteries, and they always give, you know, offerings like this. Even if they're only giving an offering of 10 rupees per person, they're always making these offerings. So it really doesn't matter if you make an offering of 10 rupees per monk. So in India, that would be about 20 cents, maybe less these days, I don't know, whatever the exchange rate is. Or in Nepal, it's just about 10 cents, so I guess in India, it would be about 16 cents. So, you know, 16 cents, you know. And if you... It's really not a lot, and even over there it's not a lot. It's enough for a cup of tea, but it makes a good connection. And if enough people give 10 rupee offerings, then it adds up. And the monks and nuns in the monasteries, okay, in Vancouver they're well supported, they're okay. But generally in our monasteries and our nunneries, they are much more fortunate than the monks and nuns in other nunneries because of Rinpoche's activity and the number of students coming from abroad. But they do still need to buy their textbooks. They need to buy their robes. They have incidental expenses. Even monks occasionally like to go out and get momos. So, dumplings, for those of you who don't know Tibetan. You know, so for this reason, it's a wonderful way to gather the accumulation of merit. So, you know, if you think about all going over to Bodo with Steve in the winter, again, I'm getting my product placement in. If you all think about going to either to the Bodhanath teachings this year or next year, or the teachings in Sarnath or Rinpoche's teachings in Vancouver, I'd encourage you to all consider doing offerings like this. What time have we got? We're at 12:05, so we will continue at 2 p.m.